From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
In 1983, a report was leaked from the White House characterizing what was called the enemies list. These were scientists who had ventured from the narrow corridors of science into the field of public policy and who had adversely impacted on public policy. And I had the distinction of being number one on the list with an appellation. With an appellation next to my name, perfectly horrible.
Today, a conversation with Dr. Samuel Epstein on the American Cancer Society, where have all the billions gone, and an update on protests in Washington. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Elian Gonzalez case is coming to a head. Attorney General Janet Reno has ordered the child's Miami relatives to take the boy to a Florida airport today so he can be flown to Washington for a reunion with his dad. But the six-year-old's great-uncle, Lazaro Gonzalez, says he will not turn the child over. After meeting with Reno for more than 2 hours yesterday, he said Elian would have to be taken by force. Outside his Miami home early today, a crowd of demonstrators cheered Gonzalez, who said of the meeting, quote, "They didn't want to listen to us. Someone shouted, 'We're with you till death.'" Reno says she regrets Gonzalez's statements that he won't turn Elian over. She says it's up to the Miami relatives to make sure the transfer of custody happens in the, quote, "best and least traumatic way." A final vote in the South Carolina State Senate is set for today over removing the Confederate flag from the State House dome. Yesterday, the Senate overwhelmingly approved a compromise bill to take the flag down. If given the okay today, the bill then goes to the Republican-controlled House, where leaders have already offered their own compromise plan. South Carolina is the only state that flies the Confederate flag above its state house. The NAACP is leading a tourism boycott of South Carolina until the flag is removed. Yesterday, tennis player Serena Williams, who is African American, withdrew from the Family Circle Cup next week in Hilton Head Island. She's the biggest sports name to back the boycott. This news from Los Angeles. The police commission has named a panel of experts to root out causes of the city's widening police corruption and brutality scandal, and if necessary, recommend a sweeping overhaul. The Rampart Independent Review Panel will consist of 24 experts, including attorneys, professors, management consultants, and veterans of the Christopher Commission, which investigated allegations of brutality and racism in the Los Angeles Police Department stemming from the Rodney King beating. The panel plans to issue recommendations in the fall. Almost since the scandal broke last fall, there have been calls for an independent panel to investigate allegations that anti-gang officers in the Rampart station framed, beat, and shot innocent civilians. This news from Zimbabwe. A judge today ordered the government and police to evict black squatters from white-owned land, rejecting police claims they had insufficient men or equipment to enforce property laws. The court called an urgent hearing after the Commercial Farmers Union representing white farm owners demanded action in districts where more than 900 farms have been occupied for months. Police have so far failed to evict the squatters led by armed men claiming to be veterans of the war that led Zimbabwe to independence in 1980. Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe has backed the occupations, arguing they're a justified protest against unfair land ownership. About 4,000 white farmers own one-third of Zimbabwe's productive land, while most blacks remain landless and impoverished. The Russian government said today it's holding direct talks with rebel representatives on ending the war in Chechnya, one of the strongest signs yet that Moscow wants to end the conflict. Russian Foreign Minister Igor Ivanov said Russia was conducting a direct dialogue with Chechens on ending the conflict and predicted it would lead to concrete results. The statement is a marked reversal from previous claims that Russia will not negotiate with rebels until they surrender their weapons. The Russian military has failed to defeat the rebels despite occupying much of Chechnya and has suffered a series of defeats in recent weeks. A divisive presidential election in Peru has been forced into a runoff. The incumbent president, Alberto Fujimori, fell short of a majority vote in Sunday's race. He won under 50% compared to around 40% of his nearest challenger. During the campaign, Fujimori faced accusations of disrupting political rallies and sponsoring tabloid newspaper attacks. And this news from Texas. George W. Bush meets today with a select group of gay activists. Conservative groups that support Bush say they're not concerned he's meeting with gays, just with what he says to them. Campaign aides say the Republican presidential candidate is not changing his conservative views on such issues as gay marriage, which he opposes. There's been a long controversy with George W. Bush saying he would not meet with the Log Cabin Republicans, a gay group of Republicans, although when he did go to Bob Jones University, he said he often meets with groups with whom he disagrees.
I've been thinking about how to talk about greed. I've been thinking about how to talk about greed. I've been wondering if I could sing about greed. Trying to find a way to talk about greed.
The problems of Africa, the problems of Mozambique, of Kenya, the problems of Latin America started centuries ago. They started with slavery. They started with colonialism. They started with apartheid.
We have a bill for a total cancellation of our debt.
Those people, we don't owe them anything. They owe us a life.
And that money should be used for long-term development within social areas, particularly education and health.
We have to remember that the World Bank and the IMF, they have also supported criminal regimes in the third world. They also share the criminal responsibility. They supported Pinochet. They supported the criminal governments in Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua. Criminal people should be punished.
Away the debt, away!
To want, to own, to possess, and to buy. Nothing seems to stop it once it enters your soul. As you buying anything, spending out of control.
And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we continue with our coverage of the protests in Washington building up to this weekend's Sunday and Monday's rallies and attempts to close down the annual meetings of the World Bank and the IMF as people try to defund the fund and tank the bank. Yesterday, thousands of union activists rallied in Washington, D.C. to protest free trade policies that they say benefit American companies but hurt workers. The protest's central theme was labor's opposition to a plan by the Clinton administration to grant China permanent status as most favored nation, which would give the country permanent trade privileges. Critics cite China's record on human and labor rights as a reason to deny Beijing most favored nation trade status. Activists from around the world have converged on D.C. for this week-long series of protests. We're joined on the telephone right now by Njoki Jehu, who is the head of the 50 Years is Enough campaign and has been leading the organizing around this week's activities. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Njoki Jehu.
Thank you, Amy. I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's good to have you with us. As we move into the culmination of this week's protests, we know about arrests a few days ago, seven people in front of the World Bank, the heads of Ozone Action, as well as other groups protesting the World Bank's support of various oil projects that they say hurt the environment. Have there been other arrests?
I don't think there have been other arrests at protests. The Economic Way of the Cross happened on Tuesday, and the police they sent a number of people down from the World Bank and the IMF, mostly public relations people, to come and talk with the people who were there, prepared to cross the line to attempt to deliver a petition signed by hundreds of people from around the world, demanding debt cancellation and demanding accountability in the poverty reduction strategy process. And they took that, and there were no arrests that were made at that point. We do know that the police have somewhat been harassing some people around town, making, you know, and making sure that folks kind of stay on their toes. At that event and at other events, that at the Economic Way of the Cross and at other events, there have been several police officers with video cameras, steel cameras, and even one who had something like looked like a Polaroid camera, taking pictures of people who are there demonstrating. So we know they're keeping tabs. Big Brother certainly is watching.
Well, I want to talk about police strategy, but also, of course, the reasons that you're protesting and the plans for this weekend. Today is Thursday. What are the plans for today, tomorrow, Saturday, leading up to the big days, Sunday and Monday?
On every day since the 8th until Saturday, there are ongoing trainings on nonviolence, puppet making workshops, on media work, doing legal work, as well as the issues such as structural adjustment programs, what's happening to women because of World Bank and IMF policies, what's happening to the environment. What's the big deal about international debt? What is happening to indigenous peoples and to students? So all of that is going on. Today, there are a number of things that are happening. At 5:30, there's a vigil organized by coalition members of the Mobilization for Global Justice who are focused on the environment, talking about people displaced by World Bank projects, by huge dams and all of that. Carlos Chen from El Salvador will be there, as well as other people, to talk about what is happening in their lives, in their communities, in their countries, in their families, because of projects of the World Bank and the IMF, and in particular these huge dams that have meant large numbers of people being forcibly resettled in India, in other places, as well as in the case of Guatemala. Carlos Chen is from Guatemala, the Chihoy Dam, where 400 indigenous people, men, women, and children, were massacred by the Guatemalan ministry, military, because they wanted to resist, and they were resisting forced moving and resettlement to make way for the Chihoy Dam.
Tomorrow, we hope to look at the issue of dams from Guatemala to India. What about Saturday?
And let me also mention that tonight there is a forum with, we are calling it Voices of Struggle in the Global South. Our colleagues who have come from the Philippines, from Haiti, from Fiji, from Zimbabwe, from South Africa, from Cameroon, talking about what is this all about. Let us tell our story about what it means, that an appreciation for all of these hundreds and thousands of people who are coming from around the world to show their solidarity, coming from around the United States. Tomorrow morning we start with a press briefing again to avoid what the Economist did after Seattle, which was to say the real losers in Seattle are developing countries, for people to be able, who have been activists and who have been campaigners, who have been resisting the World Bank and the IMF, to tell their story about what is going on and why did they feel compelled to come all the way here, as well as why in Bulgaria, in South Africa, in Mauritius, in India, Haiti, and all these other countries where their activities happening in collaboration or in solidarity for people who could not travel here to also express their concerns. Also tomorrow, of course, is the International Forum on Globalization. There's also a day-long teaching on sweatshops. So all of those things are happening to make sure that folks are making the connections on what is happening around the world. We are also going to be supporting a vigil. There are a number of people who are being evicted here in Washington, D.C. through the process of gentrification. That's, you know, the domestic way in which wealth is transferred from poor people to rich people. The same way that happens with countries, the wealth is transferred from poor countries to rich people. We see that happening right here in Washington, D.C., and so we will be supporting that particular vigil for people who are making the connections at the international level.
We're talking to Jyoti Jehu, who's head of the 50 Years is Enough campaign in Washington, D.C., one of the leaders of the massive mobilization that is taking place this week in Washington. You're going to be meeting with the World Bank and the IMF on Saturday.
Yes, we have. On Saturday, we requested that the bank and the fund send representatives to a roundtable discussion, which will be at the D.C. Jewish Community Center. And, you know, we want to engage them. They keep saying that they want to talk. And, in fact, we do talk with them. In the last 2 weeks, I've been on panels with World Bank and IMF staff people in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and here at American University. So this will be an interesting time to have an exchange with them and for people to sort of be able to ask a number of questions of the people there. So, again, it's a whole range of events that we are doing, including a film festival focusing on videos and documentaries that have been done documenting what these institutions are up to around the world.
Jokey Jehu, then there's Sunday and Monday. Can you explain how you are going to attempt? Sunday morning, it's the opening of the annual meeting of the International Monetary Fund?
Yes, it's a semi-annual meeting of the International Monetary Fund, the most powerful committee called the International Monetary and Finance Committee of the IMF will be meeting. And the reasons why the 16th and 17th are our targets is because those are the days that the relevant committees on Sunday for the IMF, on Monday, the Development Committee of the World Bank are meeting. And there's definitely going to be a rally for which we have asked for a permit from the Park Police on the Ellipse, starting from 10 a.m. until about 5:30 p.m. And as part of that time, there will be a march. But there will also be direct mass nonviolent direct action happening on Sunday in the streets of Washington, as close to the World Bank and IMF as the police will let us get. They've declared those two buildings foreign diplomatic missions, so they've thrown a cordon of security, closed streets around there.
What do you mean, foreign diplomatic mission? They always declare that?
No. You know, in Seattle, what they did was they said there was a no-protest zone. I think Washington is a little bit more sophisticated. So what they've said is that these institutions, for a number of days, starting the 10th, I think, through the 17th or the 18th, that they are, quote, foreign diplomatic mission. So the Secret Service has jurisdiction there. And, of course, people arrested crossing the line there have face more severe charges than they would under normal circumstances.
Let me ask you something. The 50 Years is Enough campaign is one of the more uncompromising organizations, been pushing very hard against the World Bank and the IMF. Now, this past Sunday, the Jubilee 2000 rally of thousands had as one of its speakers Gene Sperling of the White House. This surprised a lot of people as he talked about issues like excessive debt, clearly not calling for the closing down of the World Bank and the IMF, and it allowed the White House to say they support Jubilee 2000. Are you calling for the closing of, the end of the World Bank and the IMF, or reform?
We don't call for our position is not reform, definitely, because we know how they do that, and that's exactly what they've been doing for so long. We are also not calling, as a coalition, we are not calling for the abolishment of these institutions. Some of our members are calling for that. We call for the profound transformation of the institutions. And when we get into the details of that, we talk about debt cancellation by these institutions. They don't need to get more taxpayer money to do this. We demand accountability for bad loans, for corruption that these institutions helped feed around the world. We demand reparations. And we are also very aware that, in fact, if they did a number of the things that we are demanding, it might mean that they would have to close their doors. We believe that these institutions have a role to play. It's not the role that they're playing. They're not fulfilling their mission as they were founded in 1944, and we want to see them get back to that. We want to see them get back to talk about poverty eradication, not poverty alleviation. We want to see the IMF not bailing out investors and bankers. We want them to be back to their mission of dealing with short-term misbalances or short-term problems that countries have in terms of meeting their obligations on debt, not on the long-term kind of thing that they have been doing. We want reparations. We want individuals and the institutions to be held accountable to the extent of demanding that those found responsible be prosecuted for cuddling and financing dictators, for bad projects, and all the other things that they have caused harm through structural adjustment programs and the ways in which they have dealt with debt.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. If people want to find out about particularly this weekend's activities, the mass rallies and civil disobedience on Sunday and Monday, where can they call or go on the web?
They can call. There's an information line that is 202-544-9360. 544-9360 in area code 202. That's updated every day and has information about events and activities happening. Also on the website, www.a16.org, a16.org, which is, has updates as well and information about what are the activities and events that are happening. And we invite everybody to come down. This is a very important time. We are changing the world, and you have to be part of it.
I want to thank you for being with us, Jokia Jehu, who is the head of the 50 Years is Enough campaign. Of course, the idea of 50 years is enough is 50 years is enough of the World Bank and the IMF established in 1944. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, a quick update from Miami, Florida, where the showdown will be taking place this afternoon. Will Elian Gonzalez be handed over? And then we spend the rest of the program with Dr. Samuel Epstein on the politics of cancer and just where have all the billions gone that the American Cancer Society has spent. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we said earlier in the program, the Elian Gonzalez case coming to a head. Attorney General Janet Reno went down to Florida, met with Elian's great uncle, Lázaro Gonzalez, who says he won't turn the child over today at 2 o'clock. He said that Elian will have to be taken by force. Crowd outside of Elian's, Lázaro Gonzalez's house said that we are with you until death. So we are now going down to Miami, Florida, to speak with Francisco Arruca, who is the host of a radio program on Radio Progreso. Welcome to Democracy Now! Again, Francisco Arruca.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, can you tell us what the scene is right now? I know you have to do a radio show in just a few minutes.
Yes. Well, the scene, as you can imagine, is confusing. Exactly as you described it, rather than in a way acknowledge what, in the opinion of most people, was a tremendous gesture on the part of the Attorney General, coming personally to Miami to talk to them, basically try to convince to solve this in a way that would be better for the child and for Miami. The relatives have really maintained, and when I say the relatives, I get mad at myself. It is not just the relatives. It's the relatives and the forces around the relatives who are interested in keeping this at a radical level. So those forces that include the relatives have basically taken the position you described, that they are not going to take the child to Opa-locka Airport at 2 p.m., nor are they going to go to Washington to meet with the father and hand the boy in. So obviously that position, if sustained, will lead to some kind of action, or should, not only would, it should lead to some kind of action on the part of the federal government in order to implement the law. What is going to happen, nobody can basically predict, although my position is clear. If the authorities make it very clear that they're going to act with patience but firmness in implementing the law, that would be precisely the way to avoid a serious confrontation down here. These are a group of Cuban Americans, very powerful ones, who are used to act with impunity. And if they assume that they're going to have impunity in that fanatical position they have taken, the worse the situation is going to become. So it's a touchy situation. The I think that the most important thing also that is being discussed here, given the fact that the Attorney General has, again, tried to recreate the possibility of a trip to Washington by the relatives and Eliane, to hand in Eliane after meeting with the father in Washington, and that is an alternative that Attorney General wants to still keep open, is a topic of very important conversation, and I would like you to understand why. The reason is that it is very clear now that that plan that was approved to have a meeting in Washington had the backing not only of Eliane's father and his lawyer, Greg Craig, but also the Cuban-American National Foundation, which is the single most important exile group here in Miami, and also of the Justice Department. And now we know that it failed precisely because more radical factions within the group that wants Eliane to stay in Miami, at least according to the Herald today, basically sabotaged the plan. And that has created also a very tough situation for the Cuban-American National Foundation, which is now denying that they knew or that the meeting was going to take place to hand in Eliane, precisely because they know it's going to cost them dearly among certain groups of the community. So this situation, when you analyze the divisions that are taking place between, let's call more moderate groups within that group of Cuban Americans who want Eliane to stay here, and if not more moderate, at least they have more to lose. Therefore, they are acting with a little more care. And those forces that having less to lose and maybe even having political ambitions, as some of those lawyers are, they were chosen precisely because they have political careers ahead of them. That kind of division adds to a situation that is not only confusing but dangerous. So we are going to be living very interesting hours and in my opinion, very important hours in the next few hours. Yeah.
Well, Francisco Rucco, we hope to touch base with you tomorrow to talk about what has happened today. And, well, we'll just wait and see. Thank you for being with us as he goes off to his radio program at Radio Progreso, his one of the few dissenting public voices in Miami's Cuban community. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
In 1983, a report was leaked from the White House characterizing what was called the enemies list. These were scientists who had ventured from the narrow corridors of science into the field of public policy and who had adversely impacted on public policy. And I had the distinction of being number one on the list with an appellation. With an appellation next to my name, perfectly horrible.
Dr. Samuel Epstein speaking last night at the Project Censored Awards, handed out to journalists and activists and academics for covering stories that have been censored by the mainstream media. Among them, Dr. Samuel Epstein, the chair of the Cancer Prevention Coalition. He's also a professor at the Public Health School of the University of Illinois. He exposed the American Cancer Society, one of the wealthiest nonprofits, in an article entitled "American Cancer Society, the World's Wealthiest Nonprofit Institution." Gets money from surgeons, from drug companies, from corporations that he says profit from the cancer industry and have little interest in cancer prevention. According to Dr. Epstein, the American Cancer Society spends most of its money on overhead, salaries, and fringe benefits, little on cancer prevention and education. We're going to spend the rest of the program talking about this. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Pleasure to be with you.
Well, you are a professor of environmental and occupational medicine and chair of the Cancer Prevention Coalition. Can you talk about the American Cancer Society?
Yes. In the same way as a few minutes ago, we were talking about a growing demand for accountability from major international institutions like IMF and World Bank, that we're now seeing the emerging demand for similar accountability from institutions in this country which are responsible for national cancer policies. And paramount about among these are the American Cancer Society, which is the world's largest non-religious charity in inverted commas, and also the Federal National Cancer Institute. Now, both of these institutions, the policies of both of these institutions, are largely fixated on what I call damage control, treatment and diagnosis, with indifference, and in the case of the American Cancer Society, to frank hostility to cancer prevention. I should first of all point out that the incidence of cancer has escalated to epidemic proportions over the last few decades, with the result now that one in two men are getting cancer in their lifetime and one in three women are getting cancer in their lifetime, and this is a major increase in cancer incidence from the 1950s. In fact, we're seeing for some cancers increase in incidence by 200%, such as prostate cancer, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, multiple myeloma, childhood brain cancer, nervous system 40%, adult brain cancers by about 80%, and about a quarter of the increase since 1950 have been from non-smoking related cancers. Now, the American Cancer Society's position is they try to explain away, first of all, the increasing incidence of cancer, and try to say that cancer is largely an expression of faulty lifestyle and genetics. Well, genetics clearly can have nothing to do with the major increases in the last few decades, and neither can longevity, because if we adjust all our incidence data to take this into account. So basically, and in the meantime, while the incidence rates are on the increase, our ability to treat and cure cancer have remained static. Now, the American Cancer Society has a budget of about $700 million a year, total revenues of about $700 million a year. Most of this money comes from the public, with donations under $100. There are close interlocking interests with the cancer drug, mammography, and agrichemical industries, but I say most of this comes from the naive public giving $100 thinking that what they're going to do is help fight the winnable losing war against cancer. Now, of this $700 million, roughly about a third of it goes on overhead, expenses, bloated salaries, and all kinds of benefits. And about $1 million goes on tobacco-related programs. That's out of the $700 million. $1 million goes on tobacco-related. And less than $1 million goes on environmental, industrial, and occupational causes of cancer. So there is almost a total denial of the importance of avoidable exposures to carcinogens in our air, in our water, in the workplace, in consumer products. By consumer products, I mean food, cosmetics and toiletries, and household products. Now, I have to stress that there's a vast body of information in the scientific literature, which is relatively inaccessible to the general public, or buried in government industry files, clearly demonstrating causal relationships between these avoidable and involuntary exposures to carcinogens and these cancers, which I've just been talking about. None of this information has been imparted to Congress or to regulatory agencies and the public. So there is a fundamental denial of citizens' right to know. And at the same time, as all this is going on, the American Cancer Society not only has actually been frankly hostile to major attempts to inform the public. And for instance, every year the American Cancer Society produces a report called Facts and Figures, in which they talk about the great achievements. And when you look at the facts and figures, and say under ovarian cancer, there's no reference whatsoever to avoidable causes of ovarian cancer, such as women dusting their genital area with talc after showering and bathing, which increases incidence of ovarian cancer by 3 to 4-fold. No information whatsoever for avoidable causes of childhood cancer.
Say that again about talc powder.
Women, some 25 million American women every year in their reproductive years, routinely dust their genital areas with talc after showering and bathing. Now, we have about 3 or 4 clear studies demonstrating strong associations between dusting the perineal area with talc and ovarian cancer. No mention of this ever reaches the public. American Cancer Society knows about this. It knows. It also has information on a wide range of avoidable causes of childhood cancer. No reference whatsoever to it. And until very recently, the American Cancer Society was saying there's nothing a woman can do to reduce her risks of breast cancer. All she need do is go and have early mammography, which basically will prevent her. They talk about this as prevention, which in fact it isn't. In fact, for these cancers, for most of these cancers, there's information which just has never reached the public. And the question is, why is this? It's a reflection of the mindset of the leadership of the American Cancer Society and the National Cancer Institute. They're dominated by clinicians, radiologists, and surgeons. But there's also close and interlocking conflicts of interest with the various industries I've talked about. And interestingly enough, even for tobacco, which many people think that American Cancer Society has played a major role, as I mentioned before, they only spend $1 million a year on tobacco-related programs. And in addition to that, two of their major PR operations, the firms that handle their PR, also represent a tobacco interest, like Edelman and Shandwick. So this is the background to this organization, which, as I say, is reckless, has forfeited the public's trust, and in my view, and in the growing view of some of my colleagues, funds from the American Cancer, which are being given to the American Cancer Society, should be diverted and given to the other institute, other organizations, public interest and activist organizations that are interested in cancer prevention. Now, there have been some very interesting recent developments, which I'd just like to draw to your attention. About a couple of years ago, there was a march on Washington headed by Schwarzkopf, and the function of this march was to persuade Congress to increase the budget of the National Cancer Institute to about $5 billion a year. The present budget is $3 billion, and the push is to increase the budget to $5 billion by 2003. The main interest behind this is the cancer drug industry, which is the recipient of most of our tax dollars funds which go to the NCI. Now, after the march, incidentally, was a bust. About 150,000 people turned up rather than a million they were hoping for. But after that, the curious thing happened. The American Cancer Society created what's called the National Dialogue for Cancer. They recruited President Bush for this and had behind closed doors meetings.
Bush or Clinton?
Bush, uh-huh. Former President Bush. Uh-huh. And they had a series of closed meetings. Basically, what American Cancer Society was doing was trying to gain control of the policy, of national policy in cancer, which, in fact, is shared at the present moment with the National Cancer Institute. And from this national dialogue, from this closed set of meetings, they approached Senator Feinstein, Dianne Feinstein, with a proposal to
California Democratic.
California, to perform an independent advisory committee to rewrite the National Cancer Act. The chair of this committee, independent advisory committee, was Sefrin, who's the CEO of the American Cancer Society, and a man called DeVito, who used to be director of the National Cancer Institute about a decade or so ago, whose track record on prevention, hostility, prevention, and ignorance was just literally overwhelming. So these two are really dominating the Feinstein Initiative. It's questionable whether the Feinstein Initiative is going to go anywhere, but the real motivation behind this recent Feinstein Initiative is, to quote from the Society for Clinical Oncologists, to ensure that the American Cancer Society retains its ability to in the fundraising level. So essentially what they are doing is that the American Cancer Society now feels threatened by patient advocacy groups like the prostate cancer groups, and it is attempting now to assert major influence and to take influence away from these groups and to be the controlling power and at the same time control the money from the public into its own coffers.
I want to talk about the American Cancer Society's Foundation's Board of Trustees, which include corporate execs from pharmaceutical, investment, banking, and media industries. You wrote about this in your piece, American Cancer Society, the world's wealthiest nonprofit institution. For instance, you say that David Bethune, the president of Letterly Labs, comes from a division of American Cyanamid, which makes chemical fertilizers and herbicides, as well as the anti-cancer drug Novitrone. Another trustee, Gordon Binder, CEO of Amgen, the world's foremost biotechnology company, whose product Neupogen has enjoyed skyrocketing success as the cancer epidemic grows.
One could go on and on. These are simply further illustrations and examples of the close interlocking relationships between the American Cancer Society and the cancer drug industry. You have similar relationships with the mammography industry, with the agrochemical industry. I mean, talking about the agrochemical industry, a few years ago, the American Cancer Society joined forces with the Chlorine Institute of America to downplay the importance of chlorinated pesticides, organochlorine pesticides, and to say that you really needn't worry about them. There's a lot of hysteria about them, a lot of ignorance about them. And so working with the agrochemical industry, They did their best to damp down public concerns on contamination of food with pesticides. And there are innumerable more examples. Another very interesting example is every year the American Cancer Society runs the National Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Now, this has been funded since 1985, as I published about 8 or 9 years ago, funded by AstraZeneca, one of the world's largest cancer drug industries, and Zeneca was an offshoot of Imperial Chemical Industry, based in England, the world's largest manufacturer of carcinogenic pesticides and other industrial chemicals.
I'm going to hold you there because we have to break for stations to identify themselves, and then we'll come back and continue our discussion with Dr. Samuel Epstein. He's professor of environmental and occupational medicine at the University of Illinois, Chicago, and chair of the Cancer Prevention Coalition. You can go to his website at www.preventcancer.com. Recipient of last night's Project Censored Award for a piece he did on the almost $1 billion American Cancer Society. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll continue the conversation in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. My guest is Dr. Samuel Epstein. He's at the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois, professor who's published some 280 peer-reviewed scientific articles, 10 books, including the prize-winning 1978 The Politics of Cancer, and 20 years later in 1998 now, The Politics of Cancer Revisited. This is a person who's been dealing with the interface between science and public policy for many years, including being consultant to the U.S. Senate Committee on Public Works, drafting congressional legislation, frequently invited to Congress for testimony. I guess the question is, what effect is it having? So you're a person who is part of the establishment, yet your work for so many years has been fighting the cancer establishment. Besides the American Cancer Society, who else represents that establishment?
Well, I'm a little taken aback at being called part of the establishment. I've been a critic of the cancer establishment since the early 70s. But I have worked scientifically extensively, and my publications have been well-received and never challenged on the scientific level. But coming back to your question, who else is in the cancer establishment? It's the National Cancer Institute and the American Cancer Society. The two of them form the cancer establishment. And until recently, we used to refer to the American Cancer Society as the tail that wags the dog. In fact, this is a little less true now. The American Cancer Society is struggling very hard to maintain its dominant position in terms of, as a charitable organization, because it's fighting single-organ cancer advocacy groups like prostate and breast cancer, and it's feeling that its turf is being taken away from them.
In the Project Censored book that has your article in it and has it published in full in the book, it says more than half the funds raised by the American Cancer Society go for overhead salaries and fringe benefits for its executives and other employees, while most direct community services are handled by unpaid volunteers. By 98, the cash reserves of the ACS, American Cancer Society, were worth more than $1 billion. In addition, the American Cancer Society owns many millions of dollars worth of land and real estate. Nationally, only 16% of their funds goes into direct services to cancer victims. By the way, we did invite the American Cancer Society to be on the program today, but they declined.
Well, they always do. There's only once they ever debated with me. That was in 1991. Victor Laszlo, who was vice president and He became so excited and emotional during the program that, that I think that there was a decision by the American Cancer Society that it wasn't worthwhile debating me. Incidentally, there's one very small correction of those figures. We've found from more recent data that the actual amount of money that goes on so-called supporting services is closer to a third of its budget. Mm-hmm. The other point that I should make is that uniquely amongst all charities in this country, the American Cancer Society also spends money on lobbying political parties. And this is very questionable from an IRS standpoint, and but the spokesman for the American Cancer Society made it clear that, to quote from her, we want to be players in the field and something to this extent. Now, the views I've been expressing, incidentally, have been pretty well echoed by the Chronicle of Philanthropy, which is the leading cancer charity, the leading watchdog for all charities in this country. And they charge, and I'm quoting precisely, the American Cancer Society is more interested in accumulating wealth than saving lives. More interested in accumulating wealth than saving lives. That was the opinion of the Chronicle of Philanthropy.
Well, let's talk about cancer prevention, which you say they devote the least of their resources to. In fact, you say they show a direct antipathy towards. Can you substantiate your claims? And what to you is cancer prevention?
Well, cancer prevention is basically reducing avoidable exposures to carcinogens in air and in water and in the workplace and in consumer products. As far as the workplace is concerned, the American Cancer Society spends virtually nothing. In the past, it has been supportive of asbestos work, but it doesn't provide doesn't provide workers or Congress with information on this. It doesn't provide the public with information on the fact that their cosmetics and toiletries are really a witch's brew of a wide range of avoidable carcinogenic ingredients and contaminants.
Besides talcum powder, what else?
Well, it's really difficult to know where to begin, because if you look at the back of a label of any particular cosmetic or toiletry, you see a list of 20, 25 names. And included amongst these names are chemicals like PEG, polyethylene glycol, which is generally contaminated with dioxane, a very potent carcinogen. There's other chemicals which are contaminated. For instance, you have a DEA as a common detergent. Now, DEA and TEA are also present in most cosmetics and detergents. DEA itself is shown to be carcinogenic 3 years ago, but since the mid-70s, we've known that DEA will react with nitrites, which is present either as a contaminant or preservative, to form potent carcinogens known as nitrosamines. In fact, in the mid-70s, National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health took action to block the use of DEA and TEA in metal cutting fluids. That's fluids used by workers in cutting metals, because it was shown by then that these detergents would interact with nitrites, which are used as preservatives, to form these nitrosamines. So NIOSH, or National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, nearly 25 years ago took strong action to stop workers being exposed to these, but from birth till death, over large areas of skin where people are applying cosmetics and toiletries, creams, lotions, and as I said before, well, I published a book on this called The Safe Shopper's Bible, based on an evaluation of some 4,000 consumer products showing which of them are safe and which are unsafe. And to all intents and purposes, all mainstream cosmetics and toiletries are contaminated by such carcinogens, and these are avoidable exposures. There's also avoidable exposures from carcinogens in food, and as far as these are concerned, the American Cancer Society has fought very hard to block information on these reaching the public. The same also when it comes to drugs. The American Cancer Society has been very busy promoting tamoxifen for the chemo prevention of breast cancer. It's not interested at all in providing women with information on causes of breast cancer. What it wants to do and what it has been doing is been putting women on trials. Any woman is considered to be at high risk if she's over 60. So, and also people who have had a family history are being recruited into trials where they're told there are some risks of uterine cancer, but they're not informed about the fact that tamoxifen has been shown to be one of the most important and potent causes of liver cancer. They're given no information whatsoever on this. So tamoxifen is an extremely dangerous drug for use to give to healthy women who don't have breast cancer, quite apart from the treatment aspect. And at the same time, they're being denied the information on the serious risks of liver cancer. Now, I should also point out that...
But don't you have to give informed consent and then you...
They're
have...
supposed to be informed consent, but the liver cancer is not disclosed on the informed consent forms. And even more seriously, there are very, very cogent reasons for the view that there's no evidence, there's no serious evidence that tamoxifen will prevent breast cancer. All that will do is treat early undiagnosed cancers. But to top all that off, we have another drug on the market, which, unlike tamoxifen, is not going to be a multi-billion dollar drug, which has been shown in 4 or 5 trials to reduce risks of breast cancer by 30%. Now, no information on this drug, which whose name I'll give you in a moment, no information on this is provided to the public by the American Cancer Society. That drug is aspirin. Aspirin. We have 4 or 5 studies showing that aspirin will reduce the risk of breast cancer by 30%. Now, there's not money to be made out of that. There's not billions of dollars to be made by Xenica from aspirin. But there are billions and billions of dollars to be made by selling tamoxifen and giving women the impression that this will help prevent them from cancer, while at the same time giving no information at all on a wide range of avoidable causes of breast cancer.
How could aspirin, Dr. Samuel Epstein, prevent breast cancer?
Very interesting indeed. I'm glad you asked that. The way aspirin is an extremely first of all, aspirin has been shown to reduce the incidence of colorectal cancer too. But the way aspirin works is very complex. But one of the things that it does is it inhibits, in this complicated metabolism, it inhibits an enzyme called COX-2, cyclooxygenase 2. So by inhibiting cyclooxygenase 2, which has been shown to block angiogenesis, the growth of blood vessels, among other things, it basically functions by inhibiting this. Now, here's the very interesting thing. While at the same time the public is being given no information at all on aspirin, the drug companies are manufacturing COX-2 inhibitors. Which they're hoping, in fact, patents. There's a big major patent dispute out on who the COX-2 inhibitors have been are owned by. One university claims it. There's 2 drug companies. But this is going to be sold to the public, as among other things, for not only for arthritis but to prevent breast cancer. But not a word about aspirin has reached the public. And this is just a perfect example of how. Of the policies of the American Cancer Society, while at the same time in the National Breast Cancer Awareness Month, they're given no information at all. They're told that mammography will be useful as early detection. But in fact, by the time you get a mammogram, a tumor is about 8 or 9 years old. And there's little or no evidence that premenopausal mammography is of any use whatsoever. No other country in the world allows routine premenopausal mammography screening. It's been stopped in Canada. It isn't used in Europe. And premenopausal mammography is not only useless because the breast is very dense, but also it's dangerous. You actually increase risks of breast cancer by premenopausal mammography for 3 reasons. First of all, the breast is one of the most radiosensitive organs there are. And if a woman has premenopausal mammograms for 10 years, and the average of a rad per breast, a rad is a unit measure of exposure, a chest X-ray is about 1/1000th of a rad, but one set of four films to the breast is equivalent to 1 rad. So over the course of 10 years, a woman would have had 20 rads exposures to her breasts, which is close to the kind of radiation women got outside the epicenter in Hiroshima, Nagasaki. And in fact, the National Academy of Sciences in 1970 said that for every 1 rad exposure to the breast of the premenopausal woman, you increase risks of breast cancer by 1%. So here we have about 20 rads over a 10-year period, which significantly, in my view, significantly increases risks. There are other reasons why premenopausal mammography is dangerous. One of them is due to the fact that about 1% of women carry a silent carriers of a gene known as the AT gene, the ataxia-telangiectasia gene, and they don't know they have it. But once you have this gene, you become very sensitive to radiation, and we have estimates that are something like 20,000 out of the 180,000 breast cancers every year are due to women that have the AT gene that are radiated. And the final point, the final reason why premenopausal mammography is dangerous is as follows. When you do a mammogram, you have to squeeze the breast tightly to get as flat a film as possible. Now, we've known since the 1920s, pathologists, I used to be a pathologist, incidentally, we've known since the 1920s that when you squeeze or compress a tumor, say in an animal, if you're doing studies in animals, even at surgery, you can rupture small blood vessels, and what is a self-contained, isolated tumor, which can be circumscribed and not life-threatening, you can open up the blood vessels to it and you can have spread all over the body. So this tight compression of premenopausal of the breast is one of the other reasons why this is dangerous. And in fact, we do have some studies which show that women that routinely have premenopausal mammography have an increased risk of subsequent breast cancer subsequently. Now, none of this information reaches the public. No information on the fact that estrogen replacement therapy is an important cause of breast cancer. No information on the fact that the pill, especially when started in early adolescence and taken for prolonged periods of time. A vast body of information, which I summarize as the dirty dozen causes, avoidable causes of breast cancer, reaches the public, instead of which women are told, go and have an early mammogram, when in fact it's dangerous, it's doubtful efficacy, and in fact over 90% of all breast cancers are detected by women themselves.
We're talking to Dr. Samuel Epstein. He's author of The Politics of Cancer Revisited, just won a Project Censored Award for his expose on what he calls the financially bloated American Cancer Society. In these last few minutes that we have left, two quick questions. One about genes, a tremendous emphasis on the gene now. We may get a whole mapping of the gene, which means more and more emphasis on genetic causes of diseases, and that goes for cancer as well. You think that's the wrong approach in general to cancer?
Well, first of all, I mean, genetics is terribly important for study of human pathology and human disease. There's just no question at all about that. But genetics can play no role whatsoever in the increase in the incidence of breast cancer, in the startling increase since 1950. The genetics of human populations haven't changed. In fact, genetics have been incriminating some 5 to 6 or at the most 7% of breast cancers. So while this information is interesting and of potential value to our understanding of the detailed mechanisms, the facts are this: carcinogens operate via genetic mechanisms. They stimulate genes, they stimulate genes to unlock the system which controls cell growth and then to become cancer. So in other words, they are a stage in the progression to cancer, but the importance of avoidable carcinogens is all the greater because the avoidable carcinogens act in many different ways, but the final common pathway is almost certainly a genetic pathway. But that, as I say, genes have nothing to do with the increase in incidence of cancer over the last hundreds of years.
What do you think is the single most important point to leave our listeners with on the issue of cancer prevention?
That, in fact, there's a vast body of information on a wide range of avoidable causes of cancer, which doesn't reach the public. There's a vast body of information showing that many cancers, which I've talked about, we know causes for them, and people aren't being informed about this.
Would you say the single most significant reason is because of the corporate control of information?
I would say that it's the massive the rollover of the media to the PR operations of the American Cancer Society and the National Cancer Institute. Not only that, but also the heavy dependence of papers like the New York Times on full-page advertisements of the drug companies. So it's a rollover of the media for which there's many, many factors. But the media basically is the messenger boy for the PR operation of the American Cancer Society and the National Cancer Institute.
And in 10 seconds, the best way for someone to prevent cancer for themselves or their family, their community?
I think to educate themselves about avoidable causes, and time doesn't permit me. Perhaps that's another program.
It is another program, and I want to thank you, Dr. Samuel Epstein, for joining us, the author of The Politics of Cancer Revisited. If people want to get in touch with you, I know one website, www.preventcancer.com. If they want to get The Politics of Cancer Revisited, where can they call? It's published by East Ridge Press.
800-269-2921. And you'll find a wealth of information on a wide range of avoidable causes of most cancers.
Thank you for being with us, and happy birthday.
Happy birthday to you.
Dr. Samuel Epstein is the chair of the Cancer Prevention Coalition. He's at the School of Public Health, University of Illinois. That does it for the show. If you'd like to cassette copy, 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Matthew Finch is our engineer. Errol Maitland, our technical director. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.